It's a joy to have this opportunity to share Bhagavad Gita study with you, as always. And I want to remind you or let you know that the way that we are approaching this Gita study this year, I begin by sharing teachings from Yogacharya O'Brien that she recorded a few years ago. And then I add a few comments of my own, and then we have time for sharing. So we begin with a short prayer. We acknowledge the divine, the source of light and wisdom that flows through all of the universe. We acknowledge and offer our pranams, our respect, and our gratitude to the teachers in this lineage of Kriya Yoga who have imparted their wisdom regarding the Bhagavad Gita. And we acknowledge our teacher, our guru, Yogacharya O'Brien. Love and devotion and deep gratitude for her steadfast commitment to this path and to sharing it with all of us. May our study be supportive in our awakening process, and may it ignite light of inner wisdom that we see our innate wisdom revealed. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. Today we are looking at verses 65 through 68 in chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, and I'm going to begin by sharing a translation by Eknath Eswaran, starting with verse 62, because it gives us a bit of an on-ramp for these other verses. And his commentary, his translation, he writes, "When you keep thinking about sense objects, attachment comes. Attachment breeds desire, the lust of possession that burns to anger. Anger clouds the judgment. You can no longer learn from past mistakes. Lost is the power to choose between the wise and the unwise, and your life is utter waste." He doesn't mince words, does he? And he goes on, "But when you move amidst the world of sense, free from attachment and aversion alike, there comes the peace that ends all sorrows, and you live in the wisdom of the divine self. The disunited mind is far from wise. How can it meditate? How can it be at peace when you know no peace? How can you know joy when you let your mind follow the call of the senses? They carry away your better judgment as storms drive a boat off its charted course on the sea. Use all your power to free the senses from attachment and aversion alike, and live in the full wisdom of the self." We're nearing the conclusion of our study of chapter 2. After the initial discourse by Lord Krishna on the nature of the divine self, proclaiming, you are that. You are that supreme consciousness. And we've been given an amazing curriculum about how to live a spiritually conscious life in harmony with the truth of our being. And the principal teaching emphasized in this chapter, beyond knowing the truth of our being, is the necessity to understand what the mind is, what its role is, and how we can gain mastery over it, along with its cohorts, the senses. And it teaches us that through self-mastery, we discover liberation from all sorrows. This sounds like a good plan, doesn't it? Because sorrow, of course, you flip that coin over and you have joy, abiding joy. I'm all in. We learn how to let go of the ways that we unnecessarily complicate our lives and instead focus on lasting serenity and happiness. Verses 64 and 65 say, when you have perfect control over the senses, beyond both attraction and aversion, the mind is anchored in the wisdom of divine self, and such a person attains equanimity. In equanimity, all sorrows are dispelled. The intelligence of one whose mind is in equanimity is established firmly. So in this chapter, we find yoga defined in many different ways: as conscious union with divine reality, the essence of our being; as samadhi, this higher state of awareness; as liberation of consciousness, and the freedom from sorrow that ensues from right knowledge; as that awakening experience, having the direct insight of the self, the reality of that which we are, and knowing this, freeing us from the primary error of mistaken identity known as avidya, wrong self knowledge. And that's only a partial list. So yoga is both the goal and the method for attaining the goal. As a philosophy, yoga gives us a map of consciousness that delineates how supreme consciousness, the light of awareness that we are, makes discernment, cognition, and sensory experience possible, as well as the enlivening of the body with its sense organs. It gives us a complete map of consciousness. And this philosophy shows us that we are neither the changeable body and mind, but we are that unchanging truth, the birthless, deathless, supreme consciousness. We are that being. Then the practice of yoga provides us with the methods for purifying the body and the mind to facilitate this direct experience of our essential nature, as well as allowing us to have access to ongoing direct soul guidance. That's a good promise. This is a sidebar, of course. You know, those moments where we're taken to our knees and we say, please God, I will do anything. Tell me what to do. And then we go, oh no, not that. But it comes back and we say, uncle, I will listen. Okay, end of sidebar. This access to soul guidance occurs through purification of buddhi, the faculty of discernment. And we can think of buddhi as being bifurcated, meaning that buddhi's awareness can flow in two directions. It has the capacity to be receptive to the impulses of the sense mind and the ego, as well as the ability to be receptive to soul guidance. Okay, sidebar. For those of you who study Samkhya philosophy deeply, this is very critical understanding. Even if you don't study Samkhya philosophy deeply, it's a two-sided mirror in essence, or let's call it a crystal, that can receive information both directions. When purified, we're looking in the direction that we would like to receive our soul guidance. So back to Umaji's wisdom, which is most important. She says, I often think of this beautiful part of a poem from the mystic poet Kabir that has a poetic description of this capacity to receive input both ways, bifurcation. He wrote, the devotee who can stay in the junction of the manifest and the hidden knows all that is within and without, like a lamp at the door. In the beginning of this story in the Gita, Arjuna does not want to engage in the battle before him. And Lord Krishna advises him, you must fight. It is his dharma. It is his responsibility. It is what he is supposed to do. And the battle is about who is going to rule the kingdom. In his commentary on the Gita, Paramahansa Yogananda brilliantly referred to this battle as being between the kingdom of the soul and the usurper king ego. A battle between soul and ego. I love that he calls it the usurper king ego. And this story, of course, is relevant for us because it's the battle that we face every day, and we can say pretty much every moment. Who will direct buddhi? Will king soul, that is guided by spirit, direct buddhi, or king ego with his minions of the sense mind? And the deciding factor over who wins this daily battle for us, who's in charge, has to do with the condition of our mind. When buddhi, when the mind is restless and clouded with confusion and desire, ego wins. Because under those conditions, there is no access to inner soul light. So we begin to see how critical it is for us to learn how to work with the mind, what it is, and how to purify it so we can find the freedom of living with soul-guided awareness. And Paramahansaji sometimes described it as living with wisdom-guided will. That's why there's such a great emphasis on understanding that the power of the senses have to distract the mind. And the importance for us to know how to interrupt that by freeing ourselves from the restless, ego-driven desire that comes in the form of attraction and aversion. We can feel that when it presents itself, right? Yoga's map of creation shows the primary obstacle to liberation is avidya, or wrong knowledge of the self. And this is what gives rise to the idea of a separate self, asmita, which then morphs into the ego self or the false self. And the ego self is propped up and maintains its position through desire and its mechanisms of attachment and aversion. That's how the ego is maintained. Sidebar. I'm interspersing my notes in a little more today. One practice that we can do, a practice that I do, is like you, I'm committed to having king soul win or queen soul win. And because of my commitment to liberation, I'm committed to diminishing the control of ego. Ego is necessary. So I'm not diminishing, I'm not getting rid of ego. It's not possible. But I'm taking the reins back. And so every time I notice, which sometimes is after the fact, that I have an attraction, attachment, aversion to something, I can inwardly just say, oh, this is very difficult to do, but I'm committed to this process of awakening. So I am going to not act on this anger, frustration, whatever it is that comes from attachment or aversion. We can remind ourselves, okay. So it's attachment and aversion that props up the ego. Sense experience itself, or even desire itself, is not the problem, Uma says. The problem is the ego's assertion of ownership. I, me, mine, I want this, it's mine, I hate that, I don't want that, and so on and so on. Desires are a natural part of functioning in the world. It's problematic for people coming onto the spiritual path to hear that we are supposed to renounce desire. Desire is part of being alive. It is the attachment and aversion to desire that is the problem. It's the identification with desires, the relationship that is created by this sense of ownership, by the function of the ego, that fuels attachment and becomes the source of difficulty. We can see that when we become attached to something, to someone, to a circumstance, it becomes hard for us to open to the possibilities that are before us. because our field of vision has narrowed, it becomes fixated on that thing, that person, that situation that we want. And as yogis, as yoginis, we learn how to release the hook of ownership or doership that clouds the mental field. In his book of inspiration that is called Fire Without Fuel, the great yogi Baba Hari Das wrote, "The cause of suffering is ignorance, which takes the form of desire, fear, anger, attachment, or aversion. We see everything according to our desires, and we get attached to the idea that it is mine or it is not yet mine. A fear of losing the object develops, and the mind uses anger as a defense mechanism. For us, every object or person is nothing more than our desires when we're in this state. These desires create a veil over our mind and block our vision from seeing the object or person in its natural way. Self-knowledge arises when the mind develops awareness of its ignorance. The mind then sees how the desires, fear, and anger caused suffering, and then it tries to remove the attachment. And gradually, the mind develops dispassion, which ends all suffering." That is a helpful reminder for us that we use the mind to get beyond the mind. We use the mind to get beyond the obstacles of what is called the lower mind or ego mind. We start to pay attention to how it works. So think about all the years of your life when you had no idea that you had this operating system running in the background of your mind. But then you begin to study and you can see this operating system and how it works, and you can change it. We can change it. We come to understand how the mind works, and we begin to make the changes we need to make to allow the clarity required for transformation. As verse 65 indicates, when we experience the peace inherent to our own being, we're free from attachment and aversion, and our wisdom becomes steady. In that steady wisdom, we live in the highest way, open to soul guidance, and we find freedom from sorrow. Both verses 64 and 65 use the term prasad to indicate peace. Chitta prasad, a peaceful, blissful, serene mind that is free from restlessness and pervaded by divine presence. Those of you who have studied Patanjali's Yoga Sutra are probably familiar with this term. In the Yoga Sutras, the first chapter, verse 33, which tells us how to cultivate citta prasada. Citta is the mental field, as you know. Prasad means serene, blissful, peaceful. And this verse in the Yoga Sutras says that the mind becomes serene by cultivating feelings of love for those who are happy, compassion for those who are suffering, delight for the virtuous, and indifference toward the non-virtuous. Cultivation of these attitudes contribute to staying in the awareness of our innate wholeness, our natural peace and awareness of divine reality. So in this instance, the practice is that buddhi is reflecting the divine light with these attitudes. This verse is informing us that we are responding with illumined buddhi rather than the egoic nature. The references that we find to Chitta Prasad in the Gita verses brings to mind the other meaning that we're familiar with of prasad, as the offerings made during a puja or prayer ceremony. Prasad is the fruits or sweets offered to the deity with prayer at the end of the ceremony, and then it comes back and is consumed by devotees who are participating. It's a blessing for all who are present. The word prasad also means grace or blessing. So chitta prasad is grace-filled mind. A mind that is filled with awareness of the presence of God. That is a grace-filled mind. And that would be a sattvic mind, buddhi that is illumined. Verse 66 and 67, chapter 2 of the Gita, emphasize that only a peaceful mind brings that sweet freedom, fulfillment, and lasting happiness. 66 says, there is no knowledge of the self to the unsteady, and to the unsteady there is no meditation, and to the unmeditating no peace. Those without peace cannot find happiness. 67 says, the mind that follows in the wake of the wandering senses carries away a person's discrimination as wind carries away a boat on the waters. So the warning comes again. Don't you think it's great the way that it's repeated over and over? The teaching is consistent, but we find that it's repeated in different ways until we get it. Without a peaceful mind, there can be no lasting happiness. Without the ability to concentrate, the focus of the mind and the rein in the senses, we don't have the access to divine guidance, to soul wisdom. We remain at the effect of the restless, ego-based desires and reactive patterns that are in the mind. This is how it works. Our discrimination is carried away by the senses as the winds carry away a boat who is without a skillful navigator. With a skillful navigator, the boat can make good use of these winds, especially a sailboat, if you think about it. But a skillful navigator needs to know how to raise the sail. They need to be attentive to the movements of the wind, have clarity about the chosen direction, and develop the discipline necessary to make the adjustments that are needed in the moment. And that's what we all need to do. We need to be skillful navigators through the waters of life and the winds of sensory information that are blowing all the time. Sidebar. Wouldn't it be so easy if other people weren't here? Everyone here is chuckling. I can see that you are as well. If only that person wasn't here pushing my buttons, I could be holy. Not true.
Yeah.
Not true. And true. Okay, back to the wisdom of Uma, most importantly. this is where our sadhana and our spiritual practice come in. Intentional, purposeful living supported by self-discipline is the key. It's crucial that we remember our higher purpose, what we're here for, what we're committed to as yogis. We must know what our North Star is. And then we regularly do what we need to do to support health of the body and the mind and bring balance to our lives. We find that we're better equipped to deal with the sensory input, reactive patterns that surface in the mind, and we avoid being carried away by reactions, by sense desire or aversion. We all know meditation, study, practices of self-discipline and devotional surrender are the foundations of our spiritual practice. Then there are some particular things that we can do to help purify the mind. And as I read earlier, the inspiration by Baba Hari Das, knowledge arises when the mind develops awareness of its ignorance. Sometimes when we have that insight into the problems we've been creating for ourselves, we think, oh no. But really it's a moment of saying, yes, I see how I've been doing this. I see what the problem is. We can really celebrate that quietly within. Knowledge arises when the mind develops awareness of its ignorance. The mind then sees its desires, fears, and anger that cause suffering, and it tries to remove those attachments. Gradually, the mind develops dispassion, which ends all suffering. In other words, once the mind begins to make the connection between suffering and desire, that sense of ownership, there arises an inclination towards freedom and a willingness to do what we need to do. One useful tool that we can implement right away today is to notice when we have this awareness. When we have this awareness of what brings suffering through desire and attachment. I want this, I want that, I don't want this, I don't want that. We find that these patterns in the mind, they're ingrained. And that is what clouds our discernment. Even when we have the awareness that we want to change, we still have this imprint in the mind to deal with, the samskara. And one strategy we can work with right away is the strategy to be aware when the mind says, I know this is a problem, I know I shouldn't do this, but just today, or just this time, or just a little bit, I'll have just a little bit for now. It's no problem. So we notice when that's happening, when we're saying, oh, just a little bit won't hurt. And know that our discernment has been seduced into wrong action that will lead again and again to the same wrong action. It's not leading us in the direction of freedom. And then on the positive side of this, the same is true with a little self-discipline. Doing what we know we should do, doing what we know is the right thing to do, and doing just a little bit of it. Just a little bit. Just taking a step, bit by bit, over time, leads us to the inclination of right action. Our just today, just a little bit, just now, justification can be turned around to help us to choose freedom. And verse 68 says, therefore, the intelligence of one whose senses are withdrawn from their objects is firmly established. And I'll close with these teachings from Buddha, from the Dhammapada. Set your heart on doing good. Do it over and over again, and you will be filled with joy. Do not make light of your failings, saying, what are they to me? A jug fills drop by drop, so a fool becomes brimful of folly. Don't belittle your virtues, saying, they're nothing. A jug fills drop by drop, so the person becomes brimful of virtue. And that brimful of virtue is citta prasad. Oh my goodness. Let me give you the cliff notes from Umaji's guru, Roy Eugene Davis. You know what the cliff notes are. Don't you? Do what you know you should do. Okay, this is an audio recording for those who are listening to the archive, but I want you to know in the video and in the room, everybody was saying, do what you know you should do. In these verses in the Gita, Krishna outlines a profound truth about the inner dynamics of peace and unrest. And these verses offer a direct path. I think of it as a spiritual technology for navigating the challenges of modern time, especially during times of upheaval, of fear and of uncertainty. Krishna begins by acknowledging the human experience of sorrow. But he doesn't leave us stranded there. He offers us a remedy. Peace arises when the senses are restrained and the mind is no longer tossed about by craving and aversion. If you're like me, and I know you are because you're a human being, things can push our buttons, right? People that we know, people we don't know, drivers, shoppers, family members, whoever, people can push our buttons. Situations can push our buttons. I expected this thing to arrive. Oh, I ordered a new air conditioner. I'm making this up. And it's gonna be so hot, there's a heat wave coming. I expected it to arrive yesterday. It's still not here. Oh, I'm so angry, what am I gonna, you know. Come on. Things, people, situations can push our buttons. But our job as yogis, as yoginis, is to notice that, first of all. And as Umaji said, to not be distraught. Not be distraught by when we notice our complete ignorance and forgetfulness that God is in charge. And that everything happens in its own time, in its own way, for the best. We can look back in our life we can all look back in our life and we can find these situations that we experienced as complete upheaval, mm-hmm. not knowing why this is happening to me or why I'm behaving this way. We can look back. And I believe we can always find something in there where we can say, oh, God had a hand in this. Look at how my life transformed during that time of complete upheaval that I didn't understand in that moment. Can you look back and see that? I know you can. If not every situation, at least once, we can see that, we can find that. In these trying times in our own lives, in one little situation or what's going on in our political life, what's going on in our work life, you know, all of it, trying to make a decision, should I do this, should I do that, we are called to fall forward into our practice. Don't fall back on it. Fall forward, a free fall into our practice. Be sincere. Have faith. Have faith that God and gurus are shining a light before us. And like we have done with our new statue of Yogananda, right now there is only one stepping stone visible. We take a step onto that one stepping stone with faith that the next one will show itself. In most situations, the entire path is not lighted before us. Is that true? You know, we're not given a map that's been highlighted, so to speak, that says, oh, you're going to be a mom, then you're going to be a teacher, then you're going to be a basketball coach, whatever. We're not given a highlighted map, but we are given a highlighted map of consciousness. That is what we can fall forward into. Our understanding of Kriya Yoga, of how to practice. We've been given everything, but we need to do what we know we should do. And when we realize we haven't done what we know we should do, our role is to celebrate. Because the key is that our consciousness is illumined enough that we become aware of our ignorance. Isn't that great? Celebrate when we know, celebrate when we don't know, celebrate. I love it. So you know I like things in threes. Three things to do and you know what they are. You already do them most of the time. So let this be an affirmation that we are on the inward highlighted path. Daily meditation is our refuge. It's a sacred time to restore equilibrium. It can become easy for us to think it doesn't really make a difference. It can become easy for us to let it become rote. Okay, I said I'd meditate, so I'm gonna sit here. Yes, my mind is off thinking about the recipe for my oatmeal for breakfast. Should I have cranberries on it or not? Whatever it is that the mind wanders into. But the truth is, meditation is our refuge. It's non-negotiable. Number two, breath awareness throughout the day calms the nervous system. And it reminds us of our inner source. There's an energy that draws the breath. Awareness of that is essential. And the third, moment-to-moment conscious choice. Asking ourselves, am I going to react from agitation or respond from peace? Sometimes this can feel like an inner battle of turmoil when we're in a situation and we're agitated, right? And we're like, no, I want to be peaceful. I want to be peaceful. I want to be peaceful. It's okay. It's okay. Bit by bit, drop by drop, it changes for us. And so we do the best we can. We do not give in to fear. We remember, I am not the storm. I am the stillness within it. So I'm going to close with this. Try this simple practice with me. You can do this any moment of the day and no one will know. Just takes a second. Don't do the closing eyes part while driving. Okay, just pause for a moment, close your eyes, take a slow, deep breath, and silently affirm, I am anchored in the self. Peace flows through me now. Inhale, anchored in self. Exhale, peace flows through me. Anchored in self, peace flows. It's that simple. So when the winds present themselves, the winds of agitation or attachment, just take a moment. Close your eyes if you can. You don't have to. Just take a slow inhalation. Anchored in self, peace flows through me. You could try this for a week, see what happens. My prayer is that we draw on our inner calmness. We remember to do what we know we should do. And most importantly, we celebrate. We celebrate when we recognize that we're doing what we know we should do, and we celebrate when we recognize that we are not doing what we know we should do. We celebrate our awareness that recognizes. Celebrate. Om. Okay, that was a lot. We have a few moments. I'm sorry for our late start today. We have a few technical things happening here. A few moments for your thoughts, ahas, yippies, uh-oh. You too. Ishwari, please, there.
Hello, hello. Thank you for that beautiful teaching. I just have a comment that my experience with the senses and purifying the senses is a paradox in a way, because it seems to me like that when those are calmed, the experience of the superbness of things, like the taste of things and everything, seems to be heightened. Yes. So it seems a paradox a little bit that is so. I don't know how useful that is, but it could be Buddhi saying that, it's saying to celebrate, you know, because this is not bad and this is not good. Like you have to eat vegetables, you can't eat a cookie or something like that. But it also, there's also the senses of, like if you go outside and sometimes you smell these flowers before you see them, you know, so it's sort of paradoxical in a way. That's all. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that. It's totally paradoxical. And the key is that you have reign over the senses. Just as you said, Ishwari, divine light is shining through and experiencing all of this reality through the senses. You have control of the senses, they do not have control of you.
Yes, you know, you don't, there is that, there's not an attachment that you have to have that joyous experience, but it's such a surprise sometimes when you're grappling with something, you know, when you're really grappling with a thing that you do all the time that you think is not right or something. But anyway, when there is that non-attachment too. It's
Yeah.
strange. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your insightful sharing always. It is required to use the senses to their fullest capacity. That is part of living an awakened life. It's the joy of it, isn't it? It's the joy of it. It is how we, as souls interact in this realm. It is through the senses that we experience and express in this realm. So it is a necessity, but we hold the reins. Beautiful, Ishwari. Anyone else in the room or online? Hi, Saraswati.
Good morning. Morning to everybody. Sundari G. I just had this, like, you and Uma shared that desire isn't the problem. It's the attachment and aversion. I mean, that was just like a light that turned on in me t this morning. So thank you for saying that, for sharing that.
That is powerful, isn't it? Because it is true, we get on the spiritual path and we think every desire is a bad one, but it's the same thing as the senses. We can have that, but we don't let it have us. Hi, Cecilia.
Good morning, everybody. I have a question about the senses and thinking. And it seems like thinking has been getting me into trouble regarding the injustice, the corporate capitalistic rising of living costs, seeing the homeless on the street, people living from their cars, et cetera, et cetera, so on. And it's boiling me up with anger. And yeah, sometimes I can, okay, get back and say, peace, peace. But sometimes it comes so quickly. When it comes so quickly, it's like a little storm in a tempest in a teacup, if you will. So my teacup just explodes. And I don't like that, of course. So I wonder, I don't know if self-talk is, when it happens that quickly, if self-talking is going to help. But what you said about the breath, long, slow, deep breathing may be my salvation. I'm thinking, and I want to thank you for that because You pretty much answered a lot about the anger, especially from last time you said there's a danger of unchecked desire attachment. And some of these things bring in the anger and the delusion. So my inner Kali is alive and well, and I know that Kali tries to purify everything, but it also has a destructive component, right? So I just want to hear what you think about that.
Well, that was a lot, and Uma gave us, well, one, affirmation is like we did just at the end with inhalation and exhalation, is really supportive when we find ourselves in times of agitation, and anger is extreme agitation. Anger arises from thwarted desire. The root of anger is a desire unfulfilled, an attachment or aversion unfulfilled. And anger first shows as disappointment, then agitation, then anger, and then we lose it. So just understanding, as Uma said in here, and as both the Gita and Yoga Sutras teach us, just understanding what anger truly is. And so then we can backtrack and we can say, okay, I feel very angry about this situation or this person's behavior or whatever it is. What is it that I'm not getting or seeing that I want to get or want to see? So we can backtrack when we become aware. I'm angry about all the homelessness or unhoused. Is that what I'm supposed to say? Unhoused people. Thank you. I'm learning. I'm angry about the capitalism, whatever. Pick one. The whole thing is too much. Pick one to begin with. I'm angry. What is it that I desire in this situation that is being thwarted? Is my desire reasonable? And then what positive action can I take toward this reasonable desire? What one small step can I take toward it? So working with affirmation is very supportive when we find ourselves in these kinds of situations. And then I like to backtrack. Okay, this is my desire. Is there an attachment in this desire? Yes, I'm very attached to peace in the world. And these are all the ways I'm seeing that desire for peace in the world to be destroyed, thwarted. What is the step I can take? And Uma shared very clearly from verse 33 in the first chapter, first pada of Yoga Sutra, feelings of love for those who are happy, compassion for the suffering, delight for the virtuous, indifference towards the non-virtuous. Then we study what's the difference between uncaring and indifferent. Then we learn. Okay, that's a lot. It was a big question. I hope those two things can help.
And also you said that anger is a defense mechanism, and it struck me that it's defending the supersensitive part of me that wants to protect everybody, right, and bring a utopia to the world.
No, anger is protecting the ego.
And there is a healthy ego too,
because there's a healthy ego, and all anger is not bad, but when anger has us, that's not useful. When we feel the intense protective type of anger, like a mother deer has for its fawn, or like Kali has for the universe, when we feel that intense protective sort of anger. That's a different thing. Then the sacred is having that through us. It is not having us. So we're not reactive to it. We're like a mother deer or mother human, protecting, not or okay, Brahmi, then Mukti.
Namaste, Acharya. Namaste, everyone. Good morning. Thank you. In the interest of time, I will be focused. First of all, I'm grateful for these teachings. Chitta Prasade, thank you for the practice of breath awareness, moment by moment, and the seeding of peace flowing through me once I'm anchored in the true self. That's a moment by moment practice. I love that. And I'm sinking into that. Also, as I inquire into the nature of anger, what's come forward for me is that what is not being nurtured within myself as part of the holistic expression of the true nature that needs attention and expression. And so for me, the celebration has been in honoring the creativity that wants to come forth and creative solving of issues in the world in a very small, restful, easeful, being operated manner that, you know, so I've discovered the need for more rest and how that can inspire greater creativity and more peace.
Thank you, Brahmi. Mukti Devi.
Namaste. Thank you so much, Sundreji. You said don't belittle your virtues. And it is so easy for me right now, both because of events external and internal for me, to forget about the strengths and virtues that I do have and the great impact that small things can make, especially when taken over time. And I find myself right now falling into that kind of despair and powerlessness a little more often than normal or that is good for me. And I think that it's a really helpful suggestion to me to remember that which is true, the divine qualities which are here, and the usefulness and strength of that as well. So could you share again the quote where that came from and perhaps tell us a little more about that?
It's a quote from Buddha, from Dhammapada.
I'm sorry, from where?
Dhammapada.
Okay.
From Buddhist teachings. Set your heart on doing good. Do it over and over again, and you will be filled with joy. Do not make light of your failings, saying, "What are they to me?" A jug fills drop by drop, so a fool becomes brimful of folly. Do not belittle your virtue, saying, they are nothing. Do not belittle your virtue, saying, they are nothing. A jug fills drop by drop, so the person becomes brimful of virtue.
Thank you.
So the cliff notes from Roy, I think, would be, do what you know you should do and become who you know you are. I'll give Roy the translation. Roy, thank you for trusting me to give your type of cliff notes. Do what you know you should do and be who you know you are. I thank you all for your attention. I love and cherish this time we have together for Gita study. So Much gratitude to you all, and have a blessed day, everyone.